ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam 7th Canto, Chapter 13, The Behavior of a Perfect Person, Text 30. Dehajibir Daiva Tantra Atmana Sukham Ihata Dukatyayam Chani Shasya Kriya Moga Krita Krita Deha Dibir Daiva Tantra Atmana Sukham Ihata Dukatya Yang Chani Shasya Kriya Moga Krita Krita Dehadibir Daiva Tantra Atmana Sukham Ihata Dukatyayam Chani Shasya Kriya Moga Krita Krita Deha Adibi With the body, mind, ego, and intelligence.
With the body, mind, ego, and intelligence.
Daiva Tantrai. Under the control of superior power.
Under the control of superior power.
Atmana.
Of the self.
Sukham.
Happiness.
Ihata.
Searching after.
Dukkha Atyayam.
Diminution of miserable conditions.
Cha,
also.
Anishasya,
of the living entity,
fully under the control of material nature.
Kriya,
plans and activities.
Moga, krita, krita,
become baffled again and again.
Translation.
The living entity tries to achieve happiness and rid himself of the causes of distress. But because the various bodies of the living entities are under the full control of material nature, all his plans in different bodies, one after another, are ultimately baffled.
This is the so-called Python Man speaking to Prahlad Maharaj. As you remember, when we were last doing this chapter, Prahlad Maharaj, the great devotee of the Lord, is touring the universe for the purpose of observing great spiritualists. And he happened upon the Python Man. He's called the Python Man because he has taken a vow known in Sanskrit as ajagara vritti, in which you just lay in one place and you accept whatever comes to you, good or bad. Whatever food comes your way, opulent or stale, you eat. If it doesn't come your way, you don't eat. Whatever circumstances come along, that's all you accept. Prahlad Maharaj asked him, I can see that you're sitting there doing nothing. Prahlad was curious, inquisitive about the Python Man's mode of living and method for attaining spiritual perfection. The Python Man explained to Prahlad Maharaj about
the futility or the pointlessness of material endeavors. And the Python man said, understanding the futility, the pointlessness of material endeavors, I just sit here doing nothing, apparently. Of course, actually, the Python man is very active spiritually. But to a materialist, it looks like devotees of the Lord are doing nothing. Om Ajnanativadandasya Gnanjanaswakaya Chakshurutamiyanatasvai Shivadevaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhupadanasya Dvaitagrada Svasriko Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama. So read the purport bit by bit. Because the materialist is in gross ignorance of how the laws of material nature act upon him as a result of his fruitive activity, he mistakenly plans to enjoy bodily comfort in the human form of life through so-called economic development. Through pious activities for elevation to the higher planetary systems, and in many other ways. But factually, he becomes a victim of the reactions of his fruitive activities. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is situated as the Supersoul within the cores of the hearts of all living entities. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto matasmitya jnanam apohanam cha. I am seated in everyone's heart, and for me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. The desires and activities of a living being are observed by the Supersoul, who is the Upadrashta, the overseer, and who orders material nature to fulfill the various desires of a living being. Let us think about our situation in this world. What is it that we're doing? Let us not just act mindlessly. Sometimes people become very fascinated by the concept of mindfulness. Whatever little thing you do, you concentrate on it. And in this way, you try to see the world in a grain of sand. When you're walking, you concentrate how one foot is put down in front of the other, then the other one comes up and goes in the front. Whatever you're doing, just concentrate deeply on it. Even your breath. Concentrate on the incoming breath and the outgoing breath. Be aware. Be aware of what? Breathing goes on in all species of life. Some creatures walk, others fly, others swim. What is the point of mindfulness unless you can understand the whole situation that you're a part of? And where do you get that kind of information about the whole situation that you're a part of? You are acting with your body, mind, ego, and intelligence. Each of those things is implicating you, getting you entangled in material nature. Just like a kitten plays with a ball of yarn and gets all entangled in the ball of yarn. Similarly, you play with your body, you play with your mind, you play with your ego, and you play with your intelligence. And what's the purpose of your playing with the body, mind, ego, and intelligence? You want to achieve happiness and rid yourself of distress. That is the daily program. Whether you're young or old, this is your program. So please understand that. Doesn't matter what age you are. Doesn't matter what gender you are, what nationality you are. Here we have persons from 20 to 40, also a little kid. We have male here, female here, persons of different nationalities, German, Swedish, New Zealanders, all sorts of in-betweens, Indian, Australians, American, New Zealanders, even Iranian, we have Iranians, Austrians are different from Germans. Koreans, a few British here and there. Moldovian? They'll just consider you Russian. So, no matter what shape, no matter what birthplace, your program is the same. Just take this wee lad standing in the doorway here. He's holding his, what is it, a truck in his hand? Or a motorcycle? Some toy. Why does he have that toy in his hand? He wants to achieve happiness. It's a new toy, yes? So he's temporarily fascinated. This new toy. All last night he was playing with it, showing everyone. Today he's still holding it. Oh, I'm going to achieve happiness. I've got this new toy. Come, show us. Come. Yes. Show us how to play with the motorcycle. Yes. Happiness, isn't it? Do it again. Wow. Delightful. Isn't it fun? How long will the pleasure last? He doesn't know. He can't think that far. You ask him, how long will the pleasure last? How is that relevant? He's looking at me like, what are you asking me a question like that for? Point is that right now it feels good, yes? Yeah. So, the question I always ask is, how are the adults any different? Those of you who are trying to reach others with Krishna consciousness, you know, all day and all night you'll hear the same kind of answer from adults. How long will the pleasure last? Just go with the flow, you know? Just take it as it comes. Be here now with the moment. They're basically just saying the same thing as a little kid here was saying. They don't consider it a relevant question. It doesn't matter how long the pleasure lasts. As long as you get something out of your life. Feel good for a few moments. Why think so much? The program is to achieve happiness and rid yourself of distress. If you want to get to the bottom of your life quickly, analyze it in this way. See how all your actions are of those two modes. To grab happiness and fight off distress. From morning to night. During the night, during the day. That's what the material program is. Just like the little kid is playing with his toy motorcycle. So you want your own toys. Suitable for your age. You want money. And with money, you think that will help you to get the happiness and fight off the distress. Now, how are we endeavoring to get that happiness and fight the distress? We're endeavoring with the body, with the mind, with the ego, and with the intelligence. These are the components of our material existence. The ego imagines, I am the body. I am male, I am female. I am Moldovan, I am British. This is the ego. The ego does worse also. Not simply falsely identifying with nationality, but the ego considers that my mission in this world is to please myself.
And of course, I will please others who are in relation to my body. I was speaking somewhere. Where was I? Oh. In Auckland, at the Loft, last Friday. And we're asking people about their underlying commitments. What do they really want to achieve in this life? And quite a few persons said, I want to achieve love. And then they always qualified it, love for persons close to me. In other words, they're not concerned with love for all living entities, just love for my family members or my friends or my partner. This is a very narrow, very unfulfilling, unsatisfying conception of love. Even taking their crude understanding of love, you'll note they're only willing to apply that crude standard to a few persons around them. That's it. I'm concerned with love. And you're supposed to nod your head. Very good. Then they always qualify love for those persons around me. Love for my friends. Love for a few of my family members. Rarely is it love for the mother and father, because generally the mother and father have long been divorced, so it's they usually pick one parent. I'm concerned with love for my mother, or love for my father. And then one of my brothers and sisters, the others I can't stand. Then I have some friends, and then I have, of course, a partner for the moment. So I want your love more. Such a narrow, perverted conception. But people expect happiness from that. Now, you think, perhaps, that you're just living with your body, your mind, your ego, and intelligence, and that's the way it is. But what is actually going on? Deha divir daivatantraya. This body, mind, ego, and intelligence is daivatantraya, under the control of superior power. They're fully under the control of material nature. But you don't feel that. Just like the little child doesn't feel material nature acting on him. He's just playing with his toy. Well, what about you? Do you actually feel how this body, the mind, intelligence, and ego are just playthings in the hands of the material energy? You've gotten a package that's under someone else's control. You don't feel that. You think, it's my body, it's my intelligence, my ego, my mind. You don't feel that you're operating with a package designed by someone else, and that package is fully under the control of material nature. You don't feel that. But just because you don't feel it, does it mean it's not the reality? How many of you feel the earth moving at, what? How fast is the earth moving? 18,000 miles per hour, something like that. It's spinning. You don't feel it. But because certain authorities tell you the earth is rotating at such and such speed, you accept it. You don't feel it, though. There's so many things you don't feel, still you accept. Blindly. And one of the things that you don't feel you accept blindly is you don't feel it, and you don't accept it. Your body is fully under the control of material nature. That thing you don't feel, but you don't accept. Other things you don't feel and you will accept because people around you accept it. Yes, the earth is moving. You think I am a dummy? You think I don't believe that? Of course I believe. The scientists have said it. But your body is fully under control of material nature. Why should I accept that? It's my body. I can do with it what I like. It's my instrument for achieving pleasure. But that body is a package given to you according to your past life activities. You're operating with an instrument that has already been doomed to have problems, pre-designed to have problems. Packed into your body is a certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of distress. No matter what you do in this life, you're not going to alter the amount of happiness and distress that you're due. We've explained this so many times. But just like Srila Prabhupada's purports, repeat these points at various places again and again. Similarly, we'll also repeat them because we can never hear it enough. Due to the hypnotic spell of material nature, you forget so easily. Maybe many of you have noticed that. You think, okay, I've got it. I understand now. We're in material existence. It's illusion. Yeah, I understand. And the next minute, you're lost in the illusion. The nature of this world is forgetfulness and bewilderment. Once you understand that that is the nature of the environment, that's the way the ecology works, then you'll be better prepared to act for your benefit. You're living in an atmosphere that causes bewilderment, forgetfulness, and illusion. Accept that point, and you can start to climb your way back to your original perfect position. But as long as you think that you're seeing everything crystal clear, and that this world is giving you a fair chance to achieve your happiness and fight distress, you totally missed the point. I wonder how many of you, when you're walking around, actually tell yourself, I'm in a world of illusion. I'm not seeing things the way they are. That is humility. Humility begins by accepting that there's so much happening that I'm not aware of. And what I think I'm aware of, I'm misperceiving. I'm groping in the darkness. Even though I think I'm seeing, I'm an illusion. That kind of humility is necessary to begin Krishna consciousness and to progress in Krishna consciousness. Yes, there is such a thing as illusory energy. So a devotee who is intent on achieving the ultimate goal of life, love of Krishna, is always mindful that there is such a thing as an illusory energy that bewilders you, confuses you, misleads you. I know it's hard for some of you to really think that material nature misleads you. You look around and you are misled. Everyone hates to be misled. Let's say you're lost in a city, and you ask someone for directions, and they purposely tell you to go the wrong way. Has that ever happened to any of you? Purposely. Huh? It happens. You know, sometimes persons just want to be spiteful and just cause you pain. So they purposely tell you the wrong information. But do we understand when we look at nature, this is what's going on? We're being misled. Many people object to this kind of vision. They say, oh, it takes all the fun out of life. But when you look at your lifespan from birth to death, what is the nature of that so-called fun? Are you really going to be satisfied just by a few moments of transitory, temporary sense stimulation? Is that all it's about? You're operating with a machine that's been designed to fail. It's going to die on you. And before it dies on you, it's going to give you the proper amount of material happiness and distress. All that material happiness and distress is pre-packaged into your body. Now, what does that mean? And why is the Python Man saying this? The Python Man is telling you,
What's the point in material endeavors when you're going to get what you're going to get anyway? We've discussed this before. In other words, you can work as hard as you want, struggle intensely in the working world, but you're not going to get one drop more material happiness than what you're supposed to get from your past life. Now you might say, but if I can clearly see that if I took job X instead of job Y, I'll make more money. So how can you say that it's all determined by my karma? I can clearly see. I have two job offers. Okay, you might say both job offers are because of my karma. But I can choose which job offer to take. That's my choice. If I take job X, I'll make much more money than job Y. So there, it is up to me. I can make a difference. Sounds good, huh? Who knows the solution to this apparent paradox? No one knows. You know? Possibly. Still, I'm making more money. That is, I'm doing it. I have two choices. One choice gives me more money. So that shows you I can make a difference in my life. What do you say? You sure you know? Or you just...
speculating.
All right.
I guess that money ultimately might bring you happiness, but it's not...
So what are you really saying then?
Well, it's just a material difference. It's not actually...
But, you know, we're materialists. Is it a material difference what we're all about, you know? No, we're talking about materialism. So the fact is, you indeed may increase the amount of income in your life, but you can increase the amount of happiness. That is the point. So whether you take job X, which gives you double the income of job Y, still you're destined to get only a certain amount of happiness. You can't change that. This is the mystery revealed. It's not that your income is guaranteed minutely. The laws of karma said, according to my past life, I will get, you know, 499.50 cents per week. No, it doesn't work like that. According to your past karma, you'll get a certain amount of happiness no matter what you do. So you can play around doing this or that, change jobs, this and that. Although it's also true that your job opportunities are generated by your past, but still you have some leeway. But the leeway doesn't change the amount of material happiness you're going to get. Just like you might go to a party and, well, I've got a choice here. Will it be Janet or will it be June? Both of them have had a bit too much to drink. Both of them are, you know, yeah, responding to my eye contact. Which one will it be? Yeah. Who will give the more pleasure? So then you might say, this shows I have choice. I can generate my own destiny. I have freedom. Will it be Janet or June? But what is the actual fact? Whether it's Janet or June, you're only going to get the amount of material happiness that's already predestined to you. You can increase the amount of material happiness in your life one bit than what you're supposed to get. Nor can you decrease the amount of suffering you're supposed to get one bit. we've explained before. If you've got a headache, you take some aspirin. So you might say, just see, I have solved the distress problem. I had a headache, I was suffering, I took aspirin, the headache went away. Isn't that reducing distress? No. What happens is that you haven't altered the sum total of distress you're supposed to get. You just transferred it, but that distress will come to you another way because you have to get your due. So you stop the distress coming because of the aspirin, you took it, got rid of your headache. That same distress that you're allotted, that you're meant to get, will come another way. So you haven't made a solution. This is the point. You have not made a real solution to the problem of happiness and distress. You're just juggling. Will I get distress this way or that way? Will I get my allotted happiness this way or that way? Will June give it to me? Will Janet give it to me? But it's all prepackaged according to your past activities. The very body that you're walking around with is just a pre-designed mechanism to give you what you deserve. Generally, people's bodies are very dear to them when they're not sick. As soon as you get sick, then you realize, oh, your body is a miserable thing. But when you're not sick and you're in good health, it seems so nice to have a body, doesn't it? Of course, as soon as you get sick, you curse the body. But when you're healthy, it seems a natural thing to have a body. But that body is a mechanism given to you by material nature to hand you your fate, to hand you your karma. So you're walking around with that mechanism and you're identifying with it. It's me. You don't see how the body is fully under control of material nature. It's like this little boy, he doesn't see. If you ask him, he'll say, well, why should I think about those things? That's not the point of life. I have my motorcycle toy. I have my mother to put my head on her lap. What more is there to life? Now, how are the adults any different? You ask any full-blooded male, what would he say? Yeah, I've got my partner, yeah, I've got some beer, TV. What more is needed? Except a few drugs every once in a while, you know. And what, you ask the typical lady, say, oh, I've got some money, I've got a house, a flat of my own. I've got a partner to pay attention to me. From the partner may come a kid when I want to, and I'll get rid of the partner and keep the kid. What more do you want? Life goes on. What's the problem? We don't feel that this body is fully under control of material nature. Just think about it. You're operating with a device that's under someone else's control. That doesn't sound too good, does it? My body is under the control of someone else, something else. My body is under control of material nature. I thought it's mine to achieve my desires, to fulfill my ambitions. In fact, you're operating with property owned by someone else. But we're busy walking around all day. This is my body to achieve my goals. This is our ridiculous situation. You plan what in your changing from one body to another. You're always making plans, and these plans are always baffled. Some of you might say, well, I've never felt my plans baffled. Hmm. Have you gotten all the happiness you've wanted? Of course not. There was always some barrier. Even if you could be with your favorite person, you can't get all the happiness you want out of that person. It's a frustrating thing, too. Just look at each other and say, but we love each other. Why can't we get more happiness out of each other? We squeeze and squeeze and squeeze, but still it's the same amount of happiness we get from each other, even though we love each other. It becomes frustrating after a while. You begin to wonder, what is the barrier to happiness in this world? The barrier for material happiness in this world is your karma. Now, sometimes people object. How can you present karma as a logical explanation for suffering in this life when no one remembers what they did in their past life? In other words, you might say that this person has some birth defect and is causing suffering. And that birth defect is due to bad activities done in their previous life. But this is not fair. The person doesn't remember exactly what he or she did to get the birth defect. So what kind of justice is this? In which you're punished and you can't remember the wrong thing that you did. Some people say like that. In court, when you committed a crime and the judge is sentenced, he's sentencing you, he always gives a comment that because you did such and such, now this is how you'll be punished. I advise you, don't do this again. So you're aware that I did activity X and therefore I'm getting punishment Y. But these people who object to karma say, you don't remember what you did in your past life. So how can it be fair? In other words, what kind of God is it that would punish you without reminding you of what you did that was wrong in the previous life? Why can't I remember that in my past life I stole some money, therefore in this life someone stole some money from me? But this is a very simplistic understanding of karma. The fact is, in our past life, we've done so many things wrong, you can't remember it all. So people who object like that, they think, I did one major wrong thing in my past life. That's got to be karma, the karmic explanation. You did one wrong thing. You ran over someone with a car in your past life, so in this life, someone ran over you. It's not like that. It's a very simplistic understanding. In your past life, you did a network, a complexity of bad karma. So in this life, you get a complexity, a network of bad karma. Also, you've done some good karma in your past life, and in this life, you get some good things happening to you. So it's a complexity. It's not just a simple thing. It's like the Bible says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That's the general simplistic principle. But karmic activity is very complex. You've done some good, some bad. And therefore in this life, you get some good and some bad. Furthermore, besides this point about the complexity of the network of karma, also the point is there that you're not supposed to change yourself by memory. You can't change yourself just by memory. Oh, I remember in my past life I did such and such, and therefore now I'm being punished. That is not enough to change you. You need knowledge. You see, like it or not, you're living in an atmosphere of forgetfulness. And that forgetfulness is so intense that even if you could remember so many things you did in your past life, You forget it anyway. You forget the impact and do the same mistake again. That's the way material nature works. You can't solve the problems of material existence just by memory. Ask anyone who takes drugs, for example. They know it brought about suffering, but then they do it again. Did memory help? Any of you had that experience? Drinkers, well, the same thing. They got drunk, hungover. You can remember that. Some of you had that experience. You drink, you get hungover. And then, the next weekend, you remember that you were in misery before from drinking, but you do it again. Why? Because memory is not enough in this world. It's not so important that whether you remember something or not. The important thing is whether you have knowledge or not. You have to have knowledge powerful enough to pick you up from the illusion of material existence. It's not memory that's going to save the day. Oh, if I could only remember my past life, then I wouldn't get into trouble. All of you have had experiences in your material life of remembering that something gave pain, but still you went and did the same thing again. It's like a person say, I'll never fall in love again, I'll never get drunk again, I'll never take drugs again. At the time of childbirth, women say, I'll never have another child again, it was so painful. Few months later, weeks later, even next weekend, same thing again. Did you say like that when you had your child? Yeah, it's just never again, never again. But what do you think? Right, you will. Yeah, a few years, yes. Another one, right? You remember, but the memory is not enough, right? It passed, right? But during the time of childbirth, you were there? Ah! Was she screaming? Was she screaming?
Under sedation.
Still, never again, you were saying, right? One is enough. Ah. Yes. Yes. Never again, right? But now? Oh, yes, another. So she remembers, but still. You see? What is this objection to karma that it's not fair? You don't remember your past life's activity, so how can you be punished for it in this life? Memory is not what saves the day. It is only Krishna consciousness that saves the day. You're a tiny living entity. Memory is not enough to protect you against the power of the material energy. It's not enough to protect you against the illusion. You have to become Krishna conscious. In other words, you must situate yourself on a different platform for living. Then you'll be safe. You have to take shelter. I'll never forget. Today is Boxing Day. So last year on Boxing Day, you know, there was this huge tsunami in Asia, killing hundreds of thousands of people. So in India, on the east coast of India, near Chennai, people were on the beach. And all of a sudden, the water started to recede very strangely and rapidly, leaving the beach, the shore, which was normally covered by water, now was uncovered, and the water was receding rapidly back into the ocean. Everyone just thought, this is very strange, but anyway, we're on the beach, things are nice. One man was a scientist, And as soon as he saw that happen, he started running and yelling, "Tsunami! Tsunami!" He knew the symptoms, and he was running away from the beach. No one paid him any attention. No one. They didn't have the knowledge he had. So it's the same with the Krishna conscious person. You know the symptoms of material nature. You study the Bhagavatam. You're running away from material existence, and then people criticize. What are you doing? How can you do this? How can you leave us here? We're enjoying, you enjoy with us. Even if we're suffering, so what? Suffer with us. We're a family. We're a community. We're a nation. Suffer with us. How can you run away? But then you point out, look, there's this, there's that. The tsunami is coming. Oh, why are you so negative? So the scientist was running away the opposite direction, but no one would listen to him. No one. It just shows you. You can even have knowledge and try to warn people, but if they're too attached to their material enjoyment, they won't listen. He didn't listen to the scientists. Oh, run away from the beach. No way. It's a great day. It's interesting what the ocean is doing. It's receded so fast. We can see rocks on the that we never saw before. A minute or two later, that was the end. Our memory is not enough to protect us against illusory energy. So this objection to karma, that it's not fair, no one remembers what they did in their past life to deserve the suffering they're getting in this life. The point also is not to remember what you did in your past life. The point is to remember Krishna's instructions. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita do you see Krishna say, "I want you to remember what you did in your past life, and that'll help you not to do the same thing again." There's no verse in Bhagavad Gita like that. But Krishna says, think of me, remember my instructions, and then you'll get out of the ocean of material existence. Not from remembering how you suffered, or not from remembering the wrong things you did in your past life, but remembering Krishna's instructions. We've explained before, there's a very simple test to see if you made a mistake in your past life. You don't have to remember every isolated incident that you did. But if you look in the mirror when you wake up in the morning and you see a material body, you know you made some mistakes. Why do things have to be more complicated than that? So try it. Go look in the mirror. What do you see? If you see a material body, well, it means you made quite some mistakes in your past life. Not bad enough to deserve an animal body, but bad enough to get a material body. Do you need to know anything more than that? You see, the goal of life is not to understand every little thing you did in your past life. The goal of life is to escape material existence by remembering Krishna's instructions. So therefore, the whole thrust of Bhagavad Gita is not about remembering every little thing you did in your past life. The thrust of Bhagavad Gita is about remembering Krishna's instructions, which bring an end to the cycle of repeated birth and death. Another thing people may object is that, I can't believe that the way people are suffering now, they're tortured, they have some horrible disease. They're burned alive in house fires. What could they have done in their past life that would deserve that? Sometimes people say like that. What could you have done so horrible that you deserve to be tortured, you deserve to be burned alive in a house caught on fire? But who are you to be the judge, the jury, and the hangman? It's not for you to decide what is the severe crime and what is not. You might think, well, so what if I, you know, just had a nice steak? Big deal. Why does that mean I have to be killed? Everyone eats steak. So maybe I had a few steaks in my last life. Why does it mean I have to be slaughtered in this life? A steak is one thing, and I'm another thing. People think like that. They think that what they did was of no real significance. A little bit of steak here and there. They don't understand the laws of material nature. Just like, probably you heard about it in New Zealand. It was big news in Australia. This Australian citizen who was hung in Singapore for drug smuggling. He was transiting at Singapore Airport, changing flights. He hadn't officially entered the country, although the whole airport's still part of the country. He was in the transit area. He was changing from one flight to another. And while waiting for his flight, he fell asleep. And he woke up realizing, I'm about to miss my connecting flight. So he ran to the gate, and he forgot to take off his belt. Because being a drug smuggler, he knew that, you know, if you wear anything metal when you go through the security detector before you board the plane, because at the Singapore airport, just like many airports, they have a security gate metal detector for every plane before you board the plane, rather than just one in a general location. So he forgot. You know, he fell asleep, forgot to take off your belt before you board the plane, because you have to go through a metal detector. He forgot to do that. And when he went through, set off the alarm. You know, so the guy just said, excuse me, can I just pat you down? Patted him down. What's this? You know, lifted up his shirt, and there was, you know, a few kilos of heroin strapped to his body. So the penalty in Singapore for drug smuggling is death. So all the Australians, not all, but most of the Australians, they were complaining. Oh, this is unjust. The guy was in his 20s. Just, you know, the mother was crying. The mother was young, like in her 30s or early 40s. And in her 30s, the mother was. And her hair was turning completely white during the trial. And the Australian press was saying that this is cruel, this is barbaric, that this boy may be sentenced to death just because he was smuggling drugs. So they said, think about the pain that this boy's execution will cause his mother, his family. And what did the Singaporeans reply? We're thinking about the pain of all the families who would have gotten that heroin. How many families would have been wrecked irreparably? We're thinking about them. So you're telling us, think about this boy's family, and we're saying we're thinking of the families of all those children who would have bought the drugs and become addicted. And everyone knows the law. Everyone knows you smuggle drugs in Singapore, Malaysia. You're executed. So, there was a big uproar. But the Singapore government went ahead and executed him. They hung him. The hangman was an Indian Singaporean. Last name was Singh or something like that. He was in his 70s. He had done something like 300 hangings. So he even told the press, because he thought that he might get bypassed for this job by a younger guy, you know, because maybe the government was thinking he's getting too old for the job. So he, don't let them bypass me. I guarantee you, I know how to put the noose on the neck, around the neck. It'll be a work of art. But if a young, inexperienced guy does it, I guarantee you, the boy's gonna flop around like a chicken. But if I do it, clean break of the neck, no problem. In the end, he did it. And in Australia, they had a moment of silence. At least in Queensland, the state of Queensland, they declared a moment of silence for in honor of this boy who was executed. Some people have the intelligence to complain. We're having a moment of silence for an admitted and convicted heroin smuggler. This is how low things have got these days. People are dying all the time in Australia. And now we're having a moment of silence for a convicted heroin smuggler who was hung. How low are things getting? A few people said like that, but most people were just carried away by this sentiment. Oh, he was a 25-year-old boy. He was smuggling heroin, there's no doubt about it, but why was he hung? So in this way you see that the people didn't accept that this is a proper punishment for what he did. The hangman, it's his methodology. And he's a Hindu, so right when he puts the noose around the neck, he whispers into each person's ear that he's executing, "You're going to a better place, don't worry." That is true. If the Shastra points out that if someone is executed by the government for a crime they did, it wipes their karma clean. But because they still have the material desires that got them into trouble in the first place, in their next life, they'll ruin themselves again because those material desires haven't been purified. If someone murders someone and then they're caught and executed by the government, their karmic slate is wiped clean, but they easily get themselves in trouble again because the dirty things in the heart haven't been purified. The dirty things in the heart can't be purified in the karmic process of countering a bad karma with some atonement. It doesn't touch the heart. This is the subject of the sixth canto of Bhagavatam. So all the past few weeks, people in Australia have been thinking about this. Capital punishment. They remember that in 1984 or something like that, two Australians were hung in Malaysia. You can now go to Malaysia and take a tour of the old prison where people were hung. They take high school groups through there, and they have a recording of music. Not music, but it's a sound recording of the footsteps a person would take approaching the gallows. You hear the footsteps, you know. And then they show you the gallows, you know, the trap door underneath where you stand, and then you plunge through the trap door. They open the trap door and down you go. And then after the school children see all that in this tour of the old prison, the sound recording says, "Drugs mean death. Drugs mean death. Drugs mean death." So an Australian lady was taking her school group, I guess they were touring Malaysia, so they went to the prison, and they went through this tour of the gallows with the recordings. And so the teacher commented, "How barbaric, how cruel. I looked at the children and they were afraid." That was her take on the whole situation. The children were frightened. It never dawned on her that the whole point of the exhibit is to frighten the children so they won't take drugs. But she didn't figure out the, you know, don't take drugs part. She just, it's fear, it's not right. The children were afraid. This is how crazy things are, too. She didn't consider for one moment that it's good to motivate persons with fear not to take drugs. She just was a bit new agey. "Ooh, this fear thing is not good. Never mind the drugs, the fear thing is not good. You shouldn't make people afraid." So now you can understand why people are not concerned with what they do with their bodies. They're not concerned with understanding that their bodies are fully under control of material nature. They can't see it, and they don't want to see it. It's my body, my future, my destiny. They can't see that the body is just a machine, pre-fashioned according to your past life, and the amount of happiness and distress you get is already meted out. It's already measured. Ishvar sarvabhutanam hridayesha arjuna tishtati brahmayan sarvabhutani yantra rudhani maya. The Lord is situated in everyone's heart, and as one desires, the Lord gives one various types of bodies, which are like machines. Riding on such a machine, the living entity wanders throughout the universe under the control of material nature and its modes. Thus, the living being is not at all free to act, but is fully under the control of material nature, which is fully under the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I wonder, how many of you actually meditate on this point, that your body is fully under the control of material nature? Raise your hand. Just a few. All of you, the rest of you just take it as it is. Oh, it's my body, and yeah, I'll do a little Krishna consciousness. Yeah, that's kind of nice. And you have to think about these things. This body, which I'm identifying with, is fully under the control of another power. You see, in your mind, you imagine so many things for yourself. But that's all you can do is imagine. Meanwhile, material nature inflicts upon you what it likes, according to your just deserts, according to your past activities. Now, what should you do? Just sit around and moan, oh, I'm just going to get what I'm supposed to get. That's the way it's going to be. Oh. No, you should learn how to escape the cycle of repeated birth and death. Escape material nature. Now, who is teaching that technology? How to escape control of material nature? Where do you learn that? How many of you have gone to university and asked, I'd like to take a course that will teach me how to escape the control of material nature? Any university you've gone to taught that? Any shops on the street where you can go that will give you the ability to escape the control of material nature? They'll sell you something that will do that? No. No merchandise available. No institution available. Actually, only this Krishna Consciousness Society is teaching you how to fully escape material nature. As soon as a living entity is victimized by material desires to lord it over material nature, he is subjected to the control of material nature, which is supervised by the Supreme Soul. Now, how many of you actually feel that you've been victimized by material desires? Raise your hand. That's quite a strong statement, is it? Victimized by material desires. Now, generally you think, well, but they're my desires. What's wrong with having desires as long as they're mine? I felt like doing this. I felt like doing that. Isn't that life? Aren't you supposed to express yourself? Aren't you supposed to cultivate your idiosyncrasies? We don't see the whole picture. Just like this child, he didn't see the whole picture. He was quite honest. I have my motorcycle toy. I'm happy now. What more to life is there? Why should I think of more? So in this way, older people, older than the child, that is, they say the same thing. Why are you trying to get me to think of more? What's wrong with me having desires? What's wrong with my having desires? You don't see the result of your desires, how they lead to further control by material nature, because you don't know how to desire perfectly. Krishna consciousness teaches you how to desire in perfection. Otherwise, you become victimized by your material desires. Just like this boy who was hung in Singapore. He thought, I'm just doing a bit of a dope deal. What's the big, you know, no problem. You know, I gotta die. I just wanted to make some extra money, buy a new car. They're gonna hang me, but I just carrying a few bags of, you know, drugs. It's no big deal. People buy it. People want it. Just a few little plastic bags around my waist. Are they going to take my life? He could argue the same. But you'll say, oh, he should. Everyone knows if you get caught dealing drugs in Singapore. Everyone knows that, right? You all know that, right? Why did he do it? To make money, to achieve his desires. Well, there is victimization by material desires. Now you'll say, but that doesn't compare to us. We would never smuggle heroin to Singapore. First of all, we'd never smuggle heroin. And secondly, we wouldn't do it in Singapore, dummies. But you're doing a lot of other things. They're just as stupid, but you don't see it. Why? Because it's my desire. It's my plan. And therefore, it'll work out. It's okay. It'll be all right. Everyone rationalizes their own private desires. Just like this boy was hung did. I was doing a little bit of drug dealing. It's a big deal, you know. I'm 28 years old. I mean, you know, why did they hang me for that? The Australians who were hung in Malaysia in 1983... when they were first going to court, the Australian newspapers were interviewing them. And the boys were just, they're in their 20s. They were just saying things like, oh, well, it'll all work out. It'll be okay. You know, they couldn't believe it's really going to happen. You know, just doing a bit of an innocent drug deal, you know. Not killing anyone. Not robbing anyone. Just a bit of heroin, you know. So they were saying like that to the reporters. Ah, it'll work out, you know. Anyway, you know, we all know that in Malaysia they don't hang white men, so they thought they had it all figured out, you know. They would never dare do such a thing. But they did. And then when they were leaving the courtroom, when they'd finally been sentenced, and then they were just in a daze, you know, The newspaper reporters from Australia were there in Malaysia. They interviewed them as they came out of the courtroom, shackled, you know, that they had already been sentenced to death. And what did the news reporters ask? How do you feel? One of the guys just, you know, kind of, what the blank do you think? Like, you know. That was his answer. On one level, it's funny. On another level, it's quite sad. Put yourself in those shoes. You think you're going to get away with it, everything you did in your life. I had a bit of a fling last weekend. Everyone does it. A bit of intoxication, a bit of illicit sex. What's so severe about that? Are you going to tell me that that's what's making the problems in the world? Come on, Hare Krishna. You really think a little bit of weekend fun is causing the world problems? What's wrong with having a bit of pleasure? You guys got a problem with that? So in this way, just like people were protesting that this drug smuggler was hung, we protest about ourselves. He had his rationalizations. Oh, I was going to give some of the money to my mother. I was going to get a new car. You know, what's the problem? I'm just a young man in my 20s. Death penalty, why? So, similarly, the conditioned souls in material existence, they're saying, rationalizations. It doesn't work, though, because your body is fully under control of material nature, and material nature does with you what it likes. You're like a leaf on the waves of the ocean. The waves are carrying you wherever they like. You don't understand the whole system. So this is what it means to be victimized by material desires. The result is that one again and again makes plans and is baffled. But as foolish as he is, he cannot see the cause of his bafflement. Whoever told you that it's the job of material nature to teach you anything? Now, you've explained this before. The job of material nature is not to educate you. The job of material nature is not to let you see. The job of material nature is to bewilder you, confuse you. That's the kind of environment you live in. An environment that's meant to bewilder and confuse and illusion you. Think about that. This cause is distinctly stated in Bhagavad Gita. Because one has not surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he must work under the control of material nature and its stringent laws. Daivi hesha gunamai mama maya dratyaya. The only means of becoming free from this entanglement is to surrender to the Supreme Lord. In the human form of life, the living entity must accept this instruction from the Supreme Person, Krishna. Sarvadharmam pratyaja mam ekam sharanam braja. Do not plan to achieve happiness and drive away distress. You will never be successful. Simply surrender unto me. It's a very wonderful translation of Sarvadharmam pratyaja. Do not plan to achieve happiness or drive away distress. You'll never be successful. Simply surrender unto me. Now, if you make that motto your life's mission, you'll save yourself so much trouble. Do not plan to achieve happiness or drive away distress. Every morning you tell yourself that. But that's not all. You take shelter of Krishna. Then you're above the dualities of material existence. Therefore, everything we do in Krishna consciousness is focused on surrendering to Krishna, taking shelter of Krishna, the Supreme Person. Just like this little boy. Look at him. You see how he's taking shelter of his mother? Everyone can see. He doesn't have a worry in his mind. Now my head is on my mother's lap. He's sleeping. Does he have any doubts about his mother? No, look, you can just look at his face. Completely trusting. Complete security. You don't see him paranoid. Oh, maybe she'll, while I'm sleeping, she'll injure me. No. Well, this is how we're supposed to take shelter of Krishna. Simple, clear example. You look at that child, that's how you're supposed to take shelter of Krishna. Yes, yes, look. We're meant to take shelter of the Supreme Person, who is millions of times more affectionate than even a mother of a child. Now, how are we going to do that? Unless we trust Krishna. This child trusts the mother. The mother has never done anything to make the child distrustful. If the mother does that, it's very upsetting for the child. I always tell my mother about the first thing she did that caused me to doubt her. It was a major turning point in my life. Something very important. How old was I? I think I was 14. 13 or 14. 13 going on 14. And I'd gone away to school for the summer, a special school. And there, There was one girl, and she was interested. Of course, I just thought about it, nothing more. So, anyway, when I got home from the summer at school, I got a letter from her. She was in another city, like, 1,000 miles away. It's just totally impossible, that anything was going to happen. But still, when you're 13, you get your first letter. And she's just laying it on thick, Quoting various shastras, various current pop songs, lyrics, We were meant to be together. On and on and on. So I was 13 years old, going on 14, so my head began to spin. Wow. Begin to dream of what it's going to be like. Wow. The practicality is, she's in a city 1,000 miles away. How's a 14-year-old going to do anything about that, But still, when you're a young teenager, as I'm sure you've all experienced, you just have these fantasies. So anyway, she had written this letter, with all the lyrics and the pop songs in it, and expressing her heart. So I read the letter. Oh, wow. And so I got to save this letter. I'm not going to throw it away. I got to save and read it again and again. So my mother, she's, very fastidious, very conscientious house cleaner. So I knew. I gotta store this letter somewhere where my mother won't find it. She's always on the case of her sons. Did you clean your room? Let me see. And she just cleans everything. So I got this letter. I have to put it in a place where she won't see it, but I can still keep it. So I figured, I'm high on top of a wardrobe cabinet. She'll never look up there. These big wardrobe cabinets. So I carefully put the letter up there. And every few days I would take it down and read it. Oh, you are the one for me. Let me build my world around you. We'll have a world of our own. I put the letter back up. One day I came back to check the letter, and it wasn't quite in the exact spot on top of the wardrobe where I left it. I knew. Mother has been up here. She was probably, thinking, I wonder if, he's really cleaning everything in his room. I bet he hasn't cleaned on top of the wardrobe. And then she found the letter. I know, it's your mother. So I went and actually asked her, did you read my letter, mother? No, what are you talking about? What letter? But I didn't believe her. She just said, no, she didn't. But I knew she had. So even to this day, I remind her, you lied to me when I was 13. You read my letter. I'm sorry. After that, I promised I would never lie to my child again. Of course, she had a higher purpose, Her purpose was, to, keep any wild women away. Of course, now I approve of her purpose. But not then. I thought she was ruining all the fun. Sledger, you are the one for me. Let me build my world around you. We'll have a world of our own. My mother, she was cleaning on top of the wardrobe, found this letter. Who is this going after my son? Laying a trip on him. I don't even know her. I don't know her education. Don't know what her parents are like. Anyway, he's too young for all this. Get in the way of his education. So then she just put the letter back, but she didn't put it in the exact spot. So I knew. And then she denied it. So I never forgot that. Oh, mother has lied to me. Of course, now I thank her. I'm so happy you kept all those crazy girls away. But then I wasn't appreciative. Even so, now she says, after that I never lied to a child, my children again. She took it very seriously. Although she didn't admit she was lying at the time. She just decided on her own, I'll never do that again. It does affect the relationship. So similarly, this child is dependent on his mother. He has no reason to doubt her. He's going to get the food he needs. He's going to get the clothes he needs. He's going to get the protection he needs. He's got it all worked out. Similarly, this is how we should take shelter of the Supreme Person. The whole process of bhakti yoga, the yoga of transcendental love and devotion, is meant to produce this kind of confidence and trust in Krishna. Then, when there's that kind of confidence and trust, there can be a proper loving exchange. Pure love of God can only come about when you trust Krishna. Krishna consciousness means developing or reviving our dormant trust in Krishna. Right now we're trusting material nature. This is our madness. The body is fully under the control of material nature and we're trusting. Bhakti yoga means transfer your trust from material nature to Krishna. Because material nature operates under Krishna's direction. Now think, how are you going to acquire your trust of Krishna? By chanting his name, by hearing of his glories, by associating with his devotees, you revive your dormant affinity or attraction for Krishna. Indeed, by chanting Hare Krishna, by associating with devotees, and by hearing Krishna's glories, you are in fact associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I was watching everyone chanting last night, chanting and dancing. I was thinking, what's got into these guys? They're just jumping up and down and marching back and forth and like spiritually intoxicated drunken sailors. They're associating with Krishna. That's what happened. They're associated with Krishna through the sound of Krishna's name. And then you'll trust Krishna. Just like when you take prasad. Everyone's trusting Krishna then, right? You know, the prasad tastes so different. It's not like ordinary food. It's got to be spiritual. You trust. So similarly, you have to learn to trust Krishna in everything. Then there can be a relationship of love. So once again, meditate on this child, sleeping so peacefully. His mother has her hand over his head, his head's on the lap. That is how we're meant to take shelter of Krishna. Through so-called happiness and distress of this world. So-called happiness and distress is not very important. You should have your vision on higher things. The pure love in the relationship between the living entity and the Supreme Personality of God is far beyond material happiness and distress. You may say, if I don't try for happiness and don't try to defeat distress, what am I going to do with my life? What you do with your life? You revive your dormant love for Krishna. That has nothing to do with material happiness and distress. It's not that you just sit and do nothing. Sometimes people will criticize you. What are you doing with your life? You're not out there with us trying to get happiness. You're not out there with us fighting back distress. You must be lazy. No, we are very active and dynamic about the real goal of life. How to revive our love of Krishna. We're tired of material happiness and distress. It's been going on from birth after birth in so many species and so many planets. Enough is enough. Now let us take shelter of Krishna in full knowledge so we'll feel fully secure. All right. Any questions? Yes, that is perfectly true. Any proper teacher always gives you all the information needed before you take the test. Why would Krishna want to give a situation to you that you can't handle? You have the knowledge to handle it. A devotee has the knowledge to handle any test that Krishna sends. One devotee was going to school in Auckland. Auckland University told me that there was a big exam, and the teacher put the questions for the exam on the bulletin board in public. What kind of test is that called, where they give out the questions first? Right. So that, you know, they think that you'll actually learn better that way. So the teacher put the professor put the questions on the board for all the students to copy down, knowing that any student who was really wanting to do well in the course would, you know, take the exam questions and really study. And so when it was time for the exam, they would actually know a lot. But what happened was someone took the questions down from the bulletin board. One student just said, hey, why do I have to copy them? I'll just take them down, you know? And then so the other students went and told the professor, hey, someone took the questions off the bulletin board. And what was the professor's response? I guess it's tough luck, you know? I put them on the board, someone took them down, and it's just the way it is. Those of you who didn't see them, I guess, it's just the way the cookie crumbles. And the professor actually said that. So we might think, oh, this is how Krishna will treat me. I'll take shelter of Krishna and he'll send me a situation in which is more than I can handle. Krishna will do something to me that's unpredictable. And will this mother do that to her child? Will she throw her son into a situation in which the son is not prepared? Of course not. Did you teach him how to cross streets yet? Yes, right? You wouldn't let him just walk out into the street and speculate what to do. How long did you take teaching him how to cross the street? Yes, you prepare him. You wouldn't just say, okay, my boy, there's a street. Let's see how you do. So why do we have this fear that Krishna is going to put us in a situation which we're totally unable to handle and he'll get some kind of sadistic pleasure out of it? Ah, just see these devotees struggling. Ah. No. You always have the means, the ability to make your way through any situation in devotional service. You just have to think, reflect upon all the skills that you've accumulated, all the knowledge you've accumulated, all the resources you have at your disposal, all the guidance that's available, and you can pass over any obstacle by Krishna's grace. Anything else? Yes.
How does happiness and stress
You get some semblance of it all, but it's not the same as karmic happiness and distress. It is something personally given to you by Krishna, just so that you'll understand the truth of material existence. Karmic reactions given to devotees are not really karmic reactions, because karmic reactions are given by material nature, whereas devotees are under Krishna's personal control, so Krishna gives them a facsimile or approximation of their karma, just so that you won't forget that the material world is a place of suffering. But you might say, while I'm cooking, preparing food to offer to the Lord. Sometimes I feel happy, sometimes I feel sad. That's the mind. That's just the conditioned mind. It's not the happiness and distress that comes from karma. It's just your conditioned mind generating an apparent reality. But if you just focus on the service at hand for Krishna, you'll find that that conditioned mentality disappears. Sometimes neophyte devotees, or even older devotees who forget, they say, oh, this service makes me happy. Doing this service makes me sad. That's not true. Devotional service is absolute. But our mind has its conditioning, and it imposes the conditioning of apparent happiness and apparent distress. But that's actually got nothing to do with the devotional service in of itself. Therefore, if you just focus on the service, if you just absorb yourself in the devotional service, you'll find that you'll be above material happiness and distress. You'll be above even your own material mind. I can notice that whenever there's been a book distribution marathon, the devotees look so cleansed, so non-mental, so non-hung up. Yes, you all have felt it. Hey, so you felt it? You realize there's something bigger than me in my mind. Wow! My mind is not the ultimate. It's exhilarating, isn't it? There is an ocean of spiritual taste. So that transcendence comes because you're focusing on something above your material happiness and distress conditioning and perceptions. You're focusing on the Supreme Person and His pleasure. Any else? Yeah.
Just with regards to like karma and karmic debt, like if you have perhaps in a past life or even in this life, like accrued some kind of bad karma, is it like a manifestation? Is it like a wound in the subtle body that we have to heal, kind of thing? Is that the way it can't work?
How are you going to heal it?
By using devotional service.
Yes, devotional service, Lord Kapila Deva explains in the third canto of Bhagavatam. Devotional service dissolves the subtle body, just like the digestive acids in the stomach dissolve food. How about that, huh? So we don't go around balancing chakras and healing holes in the aura. We do devotional service and the whole subtle body, kit and caboodle, is dissolved. Amen. Yes. By doing devotional service in association of devotees, it's the association of devotees that solidifies your Krishna conscious experience. The intelligent person recognizes, I need the association of devotees to give me realization, to solidify my realization, to protect me from trying to get my taste from the material energy. Even there may be some material inconvenience in associating with devotees, still you cling to it, knowing that the benefits far outweigh whatever material inconveniences there are. There are no inconveniences in material association? During your years of material association, you were never inconvenienced? Everyone was so considerate and patient, sensitive? Of course not. So occasionally in the association of devotees, because devotees are trying to become purified, you may experience some lack of consideration, some lack of sensitivity. But if you just tolerate those things for the higher purpose, you'll experience the benefits of the devotee association, which far outweigh any little inconveniences. It's like, one temple president in Australia who visited the Gaur Yoga Center. He and his wife, they told me in Australia, those devotees there have nothing. They're just living in that place together. They're so happy.
It's amazing. They have nothing, but they're so happy.
That shows there's something beyond just material convenience. Of course, we do want our devotees to be as comfortably as practical as possible. Still, the fact is that there is something beyond material convenience. We're not going to go out of our way to make everybody inconvenient. Hey, you're a devotee. You've got to be feeling material inconvenience. It's not like that. We do the best we can. We want to care for devotees and make sure devotees are nicely situated. Still, the fact is that there'll always be some material inconvenience in this world just by the nature of this world, the way it is. But the bhakti rasa, the taste of devotional service, is far beyond material happiness and distress. Sometimes you all may dream, when I get my own house, then all the problems will be solved. Then everything will be nice and peaceful. Who here has their own house? Is everything just automatically perfect because you have your own house? No problems whatsoever because you have your own place? What else? Everything's perfect because you have your own place. Well, everything is just hunky-dory. You use that expression here. Because you have your house, so your mind's completely peaceful, your body's completely peaceful. No. Where's Bridget? Everything is just cloud nine all the time. No. Of course, on my way here, Matt and Bridget, they showed me their new house in Churchton, what? Churton Park. Yes. That was a nice house. Big, three bedrooms. I said, well, who's going to clean it? When you only have a small space, it's easy to clean. Bigger house means more cleaning. Unless you're going to live in squalor. Everything always has some inconvenience to it in this world. Good point. Yes, that's true. You don't have to remember your past life. Just remember what you did before coming to Krishna consciousness. That's enough to scare you. The crazy things that were done without thinking, just because everyone else was doing it. Horrible, isn't it? It's sufficient motivation, enough. Not to want to take birth again, just by having fear that, I don't want to be a teenager again. That's enough. I don't want to take birth again, to go through teenage years again. Can you imagine? So yes, a genuine devotee regrets
his or her past activities before coming to Krishna consciousness. You regret. You say, oh, this is a lesson that I don't want to repeat. I did this, I did that. What a fool I was. Regret, the Shastra says, is a genuine emotion of a genuine devotee. Krishna appreciates that. Indeed, that kind of regret is necessary to make spiritual advancement. If you think, oh, I wasn't so bad, I was kind of pious in my own way. I wasn't as bad as some other people I know. That's not sufficient. We should understand how horrible our existence was. Identifying with a body that's completely under control of material nature. So that's a good question. Yes? That emotion of regret is very important. Bhagavatam states that. Maybe some of you are still kind of new agey, that, oh, just, you know, accept yourself. What's more than even accepting others is accept yourself. What do you think, Susan? How's that sound? Accept yourself. How can you love others until you love yourself? You're good and you're bad. Just accept it and love it. Then there's peace. Have you tried that one? Did it work? Right. It's self-intoxication. How about, did you do the affirmations? What were your affirmations? Can you tell us? What did it say? Come on, tell us more. So you did that. And how did you feel afterwards? But you bought the CD, right? Well, somebody bought it, right? So whoever made the CD made some money. Did the CD teach you to forgive yourself? Yeah, very important. You're your own judge, jury, and hang person. I forgive myself for whatever I've done. Wow, that was easy. Now material nature doesn't work like that. So just like the mother taught her child how to cross the street, did he tell you, mother, why are you being negative teaching me how to be careful while crossing the street? Just let me be spontaneous and just cross the road however I like. He didn't say that. Why are you making such a serious thing out of just an innocent activity as crossing the street? Well, similarly, some people say that. Why are you, Hare Krishna, is always talking this heavy Bhagavatam stuff about under the control of material nature, victimized by material desires, under the spell of material nature? This is all just negative. No, this is the reality that you've made negative. You've made the reality negative, and then you blame the Bhagavatam when it points it out. This is our problem. The mother is just caring for her child, painstakingly teaching him how to cross the street. It's an act of love. She tell. What's his name? Radhesham, see that truck? You don't walk in front of the truck. Do you understand? But as Radhesham said, but Mata, I like trucks. I'm accepting. I'm open to everything. Who
later when he grows older, he'll appreciate that that was his mother's love. And if, what happens if he forgets and he darts out into the street without looking? What will you do? Huh? Huh? No, no. If suddenly he forgets your instructions about how to cross the street and just darts out into the open road without looking, what would you do? Huh? Call him and what? Yes! But is that being negative? No, it's being loving. Just like I was angry at my mother for looking at my letter. But later I realized this, you know, just an act of her maternal affection. So we should take these lessons about material nature, the Bhagavatam teaches us, very seriously. It's Krishna's mercy. Krishna's mercy comes in two ways, teaching us what to be detached from and then what to be attached to. So tomorrow we'll be discussing Chaitanya Charitamrita, and we'll learn what we should be attached to. Both lessons have to go hand in hand, but it'll be spiritual advancement. And then the next day, we'll probably go back to the Python Man's teachings. And then the next day, Chaitanya Charitamrita. This way we'll get the full package. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.